Getting into or staying in the middle class in America now frequently includes higher education as a stepping stone, but stepping on that stone also creates a path to debt for many college students, debt they will repay for years after graduation. Our guest this hour shows a different pathway, one gaining in attractiveness among political figures anyway. Michelle Miller Adams is the author of The Path to Free College in Pursuit of Access, Equity, and Prosperity. Michelle Miller Adams is a senior researcher at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research and a professor of political science at Grand Valley State University in Western Michigan. She's written two previous books on the free college movement. Michelle Miller Adams, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much, Jeff. I'm happy to be here.
And I'd forgotten when I was looking at the red flag warning that you're right in there. So
I am right here in Western Michigan, but I am a Californian by birth, so you're bringing back a lot of memories for me.
Yeah, no doubt. You tell us up front how much the world changed between 2019 and 2020 while writing this book. Did the events of the last couple of years do anything to speed up or retard the growth of the path to free college movement?
Yes, it was a year of dramatic changes on many fronts. One of the most interesting and rapid ones that I had to grapple with in the book was basically the bottom falling out of the job market. When I started working on this chunk of the book that was about free college as a strategy to create more skilled workers, this was really driven by employers who were seeking more workers because the economy was almost at full employment. And workers in general were hard to come by, and skilled workers were hard to come by, which had created a lot of support among employers for providing paths to credentials and degrees. Of course, the economy turned on a dime, and we went from record low unemployment rates to record high unemployment rates. But the argument for free college as critical to the economy remained in place. It just looked a little different. As you said in your opening, having a degree or credential is really a precondition to getting a good job these days. So now it's more that workers seeking to re-enter the workforce, re-enter a workforce that looks a little different, maybe find some pathways out of those low-income, dead-end kinds of jobs, free college is something that can really be helpful to them. So the rationale for it changed. I think that also the dramatic events around racial justice relating to the murder of George Floyd and the role that low-wage workers played during the pandemic really also put a spotlight on the inequality that results from some people having access to college and others not, or only at a very high cost.
All right, a bunch of issues rolled up, obviously, in the talk about free college. But I want to talk about the speed with which people embrace the concept. It appears to concern you. You say it is a dangerous time.
Well, it's a dangerous time only in that the idea is powerfully attractive, and communities and in fact, states are launching themselves down this free college pathway without really knowing a lot about what they're doing. And that's one of the main reasons why I wrote this book. Often these programs are, these local free college programs and state-level free college programs are crafted without a really clear understanding of their goals and without a tight match between the design choices they make and how those advance goals. So I think it's only a dangerous moment in the sense that there's a lot of policy innovation going on without a really thoughtful understanding of how to make a program that's going to meet the needs of its stakeholders.
So your message is take your time and get the details right?
Yes, and also learn from each other. This movement has been going on for about 15 years now. There are about 200 local communities and community colleges and about 15 to 20 states, depending on how you count them, Oregon and California among them, and Washington State as well, that offer tuition-free pathways to many, if not most, of their residents. So there's a lot to learn from each other, and yet because these initiatives kind of bubble up from the grassroots, often they do that without being connected to what is already known and what experiences are already out there to learn from.
So this is an issue that touches you and your family personally, Michelle, as you point out in the book. The relatively inexpensive college, it sounds like, lifted you all up.
Yes, cheap, almost free. my parents, who grew up very poor, my aunts and uncles, immigrant folks in Los Angeles were able to go to the University of California, basically paying no tuition. California, all three California systems of higher ed were tuition-free until, maybe around 1980. There were usually some fees charged, but when my parents went, they were trivial. When I went to college in the 1970s, the fees weren't trivial, but my tuition at the time, if you put it into today's dollars, would have cost in the neighborhood of $3,000. And instead, tuition at University of California these days is more like $15,000. So it was very affordable for low-income and middle-class students and families. And as I'm sure you and many of your listeners know from firsthand experience, it is no longer the case.
No, not at all. And then you moved to Michigan, apparently, a few years before the Kalamazoo Promise. And this is one of the earlier programs. Talk about what it set out to do.
Yeah, so this wave of free college programs that are focused on place. In fact, sometimes we call them place-based scholarship programs. The key to getting them isn't what your financial need is or if you're a good student or not. The key is really where you live. So many of these exist at the level of a school district or a city or a county or a state. In 2005, this is the program that kind of launched this current movement. A group of wealthy individuals in the town that I live in, Kalamazoo, which is halfway between Detroit and Chicago, for those of you who don't have your Michigan geography down, they made the announcement that they would pay for every graduate of the school district to go to college tuition-free forever. So it was a big program, a big gesture. And another interesting wrinkle about it is that the donors to the program opted to remain anonymous.
Come back to that point then, that the people who started the Kalamazoo Promise were anonymous philanthropists and they have stayed anonymous?
But they have. They've set the program up so that they can continue. There's no endowment. They can continue to funnel the necessary funds into the program through a couple of intermediaries. And, obviously there's some suspicions around who might be part of this group, but it is not known who was behind it. And I think that's a very unusual thing for philanthropists in general and also in this free college movement. It's the only case that I know of where the key donors to a place-based scholarship program are anonymous. In most cases, we know where the money's coming from.
And you include the story of Philomath, Oregon in here, where a similar promise was made.
Yes, that is a fascinating story. And I actually tell that story in an earlier book that I wrote about the Kalamazoo Promise. And it is a precursor of this idea that by creating a very open-ended scholarship for a given place, you can change that place. And that's what the donors in Philomath were really trying to do. They were trying to open up opportunity for students from that school district to go to college and develop skills in fields other than logging, because they understood that the forestry field was changing at the time.
So there are others here and there, but are they all like Kalamazoo and Philomath, benefactor-driven, none really institutional, at least at first?
Not necessarily. Well, so many higher ed institutions offer scholarships to different types of students. And, of course, the Ivy League institutions that have large endowments and many flagship public institutions as well. If you are below a certain income level, your tuition will be covered through some combination of federal financial aid and aid from that institution. And that's not really what we're talking about here. What we're talking about are community-based and community college-based initiatives that open, that basically take tuition costs away, and state-based as well, that take tuition costs away for a very large group of students and not based on financial need. And so the idea is to really open the spigot to who is able to go to college by taking away those concerns about tuition. And tuition rates are not well understood. If you ask someone who doesn't have college-going experience in their family or their close circle what college costs, you will get widely ranging answers. By using the word free, which is used with the Oregon Promise and with the Tennessee Promise and with the Kalamazoo Promise, you're sending a really powerful signal that tuition costs are not going to be a barrier to you going back or going to college. Of course, there are other costs, many other costs involved in college, but it's an important signal, and it's an important word.
And I would think that signal will be important to people because it makes a huge difference in how you begin to view your future. If you think, well, I don't have to worry about tuition, so more options are open to me, you think about your whole life differently, don't you?
Absolutely. And another important point about these programs is that they are generally very easy to access. So we have a recently introduced program here in Michigan that's for adults without college degrees. It's called Michigan Reconnect, and you can attend your local community college tuition-free. But what's just as important as that is that you can apply for this program. A young woman I know applied for it on her smartphone, and it took 5 minutes. So that's a very low barrier to accessing this path, as opposed to, you know, someone coming around and saying, oh, you might be eligible for Pell Grants. You should fill out your FAFSA. It's going to ask you all these hard questions. You're probably going to need to do that eventually anyway. That's the free application for federal student aid that unlocks need-based aid from the federal government. But that's not the message you're leading with now. You're leading with this message that tuition will be covered.
So let's take in the history lesson here, because we've talked about your own history and about how cheap the University of California was for so long. Why was it so cheap? What policy decision was made at what level to say, well, we want to produce X, so let's do this?
So when the higher ed system, and I'm not super familiar with Oregon's system, although I'm sure it had many analogies, but I have studied and written a bit about California's system. The leaders of the state at the time, mid-19th century, created a system of higher education with the idea that it would be tuition-free. And they were doing that. Obviously, California had a much lower population. They were doing that to attract and grow the population. And very importantly, they were doing that to help the economy. They needed people who were trained at the time in mining and forestry and agriculture and all of those industries that were the bedrock of California's growth. And over time, the higher ed system also played a really important role in the aerospace industry and the high-tech industry. So from the beginning, there was this understanding that by providing affordable higher education to a large segment of the population, you would help people move up the ladder, have social mobility, but you would also help the state economy. You would help the state grow. And I wanted to make that point because that is the same argument today about why college should be affordable, accessible, ideally tuition-free. It's going to help the students who benefit directly from such scholarships, but it also helps the place in which those programs are located, whether that's a community or a state.
So this is something of a do-over then historically to get back to a place where at least some states had been. Let's talk about the contributions, though, to what made the tuition rise so high. I mean, in the case of higher education, is it purely a case of the system was broken by changes to tax inputs to the system?
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated. And I think I want to just back up for a second to a point you just made. I think it is important to be clear that free college is not some radical new idea. Free college, tuition-free college, is what we used to have in most states, and the system broke. And it broke in part because of, in California's case at least, Proposition 13, the taxpayers' revolt, decline in property tax revenues at the same time that there was rising demand for college from a rapidly growing population. And so that's kind of an extreme case of why tuition ratcheted up so quickly in California. But in general, higher education is a place that state legislatures cut funding whenever there is a crisis. And the most recent, except for the one that we're still dealing with right now, but the 2008 financial crisis is a great example. In most states, funding for higher ed has not yet returned to those pre-2008 levels when adjusted for inflation. So, and when institutions face declining state support, public institutions, they can engage in budget cutting, which they do, and they can raise tuition, which they do. So I think, you know, there's a lot of attention to what sometimes people call administrative bloat, hiring lots of administrative folks at higher ed institutions, investing in amenities like fancy recreation centers. Yes, those are a part of the situation, and there are reasons for both of them. But what's really driving that increase in tuition prices is a decline in state support for higher ed.
And Michelle, are the Promise programs largely geared to send people to state institutions, public-supported institutions?
Yes, they're almost all geared toward public institutions, often just the two-year sector, community colleges. Some programs include the four-year sector as well. And a few programs have kind of special provisions that involve private colleges, but in those cases, the private colleges are having to put up a lot of the money themselves.
Michelle Miller Adams is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, both a professor of political science at Grand Valley State University in Western Michigan and a senior researcher at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research, has written about free college for about as long as the most recent version of the concept has been around, about 15 years now. Her latest book is called The Path to Free College in Pursuit of Access, Equity, and Prosperity. If you'd like to weigh in on the conversation, talk about the costs of college, how they got so high, what we do about it, join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 on the phone, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. As you point out, there are three major issues leading to talk of free college now. Cost, we've been talking about. Equity, we'll talk about in a bit. Trained workers is a big one. And I have had, Michelle, guests argue both ways. You know, sure you need college, or nah, you really don't. Where do you come down on this?
I think it depends what you mean by college. And we use college as a shorthand often to cover the whole range of post-secondary education and training opportunities that are offered by higher ed institutions. And some of these are very short-term, essentially skilled trades training, vocational training, welding certificates, HVAC repair. We have a wonderful, well-regarded wind turbine training program at our local community college here in West Michigan. And so I think that if you want to make the case that everyone should go off to a four-year institution and get a bachelor's degree, I could argue against that. I teach at one such institution, and some of the students who are even there probably shouldn't be there. But if you're talking about the range of post-secondary education and training opportunities, high-demand credentials, associate degrees, bachelor's degrees, arguably everybody needs some of that. If you look at the jobs that are being created today and in the aftermath of the 2008 recession and in the period of growth following the pandemic, they all require something beyond a high school diploma.
But why? And I almost hesitate to go down this path. We've talked about it before in the program, but the idea of credentialing where, it's easy for an employer to just go, yep, I need to have at least a bachelor's degree. It really makes their process easier because then looking at a limited pool of applicants.
Yes, I mean, it depends. Right now, we're in a very tight labor market where employers have to look at many other types of applicants, including people with felony records and people with disabilities and perhaps people who don't interview that well and who have skills but not degrees. So it depends a lot on what kind of labor market you're in. And of course, you can go to college and not learn very much. That's certainly possible. But the kinds of skills that you gain in some sort of post-secondary program, particularly if they are tailored to the needs of the local workforce, are going to really give you a leg up in getting a good job, and they're going to be good for employers in that area as well, which is why you see these employment-focused free college programs in places where you would not expect free college, very conservative places like Tennessee, which is a leader in free college. And, you know, the simple argument is that we have a public education system that was built in the early 20th century for the early 20th century economy. And the economy has changed a lot. So it's not really surprising that you can't come out of high school and go work at an auto plant in Michigan the way you used to be able to, because the auto plants have changed and you need computer training to be able to do that.
Well, good point there. I mean, do the auto plants require at least some sort of associate's degree or some sort of computer credentialing?
Yes, they do.
Hmm. Interesting. So not straight from high school across the street?
More path into those solid middle class jobs straight out of high school. It's very, very rare.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, very much the case, obviously, on the West Coast, too, where the timber jobs, the resource jobs generally have come a lot lower and become more rare. Come back to, I want to ask about the equity portion of this, because, again, three major issues leading to talk of free college now are cost, equity, and trained workers. To come back to equity, as you talk about some of the history here with, like, the GI Bill that got so many people coming back from World War II into higher education, the GI Bill was supposed to be race neutral. How did it end up excluding some people?
Yeah, the GI Bill. I mean, it's a sad story because, of course, the GI Bill was an incredibly important asset-building opportunity for middle and working-class people all around the nation, making possible home ownership and higher education. But the GI Bill was politically enacted as a compromise measure where benefits were filtered through state systems. So for states that had segregated higher ed, which was many states in the nation at the time, the opportunities for black soldiers returning to attend higher ed were very, very constrained. And so if you look in practice at who the GI Bill helped, it helped a lot of poor, middle-class, working-class people, but mainly white people, mainly white men. And, of course, that has changed now. But these legacies of exclusion stay with us. And if you look at who goes to college these days, college writ large, any type of post-secondary education or training, you'll see that low-income students, black and Latino students, first-generation students have made great gains in terms of going to college, but there are still big gaps, big equity gaps around race and economic lines in terms of who completes degrees and what kinds of degrees they complete. So that equity challenge is a big part of this promise movement, how you open that spigot to bring more of these people into promising college pathways.
So let's talk about a state that previously had segregation, and because you mentioned it already as a proponent of free college, the Tennessee system. What kind of wrinkles does the Tennessee system have that makes it unique?
Yeah, Tennessee is fascinating because it has from time to time had some Democratic leadership, but at least in recent years, it is a solidly red state. And yet Tennessee is the state that has really pioneered these state-level free college programs. They have a program called Tennessee Promise, which sends recent high school graduates to community college, and they also have a sector called Colleges of Applied Technology. So off to that two-year sector, tuition-free, something like 90% of public high school graduates now apply for that program. It's become almost automatic. Not everyone uses it. They go other places, but it's very much a part of the fabric of education in Tennessee now. They also have a program called Tennessee Reconnect that sends any adult in the state who does not have a college degree, it makes it possible for them to go to one of those colleges tuition-free as well.
And I noticed the Oregon Promise covers tuition costs at any community college for recent high school and GED graduates.
Yes, and the Oregon Promise took a different approach, and rather than being open to any high school graduate, as the Tennessee program is, it is limited to students who graduate high school with a 2.5 GPA. So that's a design choice that some states have made, and I personally prefer the universal model because I think there are students who can be successful in some post-secondary program who maybe had a 2.3 GPA. So I'm not sure why we're excluding them, but I that's the kind of design choice that I think sometimes is made without really understanding what its impact is going to be.
And is the California Promise is rather similar to the Oregon one too, isn't it?
The California Promise is different from every other promise because people do things differently in California. It's actually money that flows to the state's community colleges that allows them to use it to make themselves tuition-free. So it's not a comprehensive statewide program, but it gets filtered through the community colleges.
To pick up the conversation then on the California College Promise Grant, and what you're saying then is unlike some of the other states, the money doesn't come through the student, it comes through the institution?
Well, the institutions are funded to extend tuition, to make themselves tuition-free, to students who want to attend that community college. So it's a little, the messaging is a little complicated. There was a bill passed that provided community colleges with funding, and this was one of the things they could do with that funding. And most of them have, in fact, done that. So if you look at a database of these place-based scholarship programs, you will find a lot in California, and that's because every community college has one, almost.
You can get into acronyms very quickly. I noticed the California College Promise Grant, CCPG, formerly known as the Board of Governors, Fee Waiver, BOGFW, and on and on and on. The, the point is, we're trying to make it easier for people to go to college. And as you point out in the book, there are three big issues in design: who gets to go, where they go, and how much money you allocate for this. And are the formulas for those pretty much all over the map at this point?
Absolutely all over the map. And in fact, that's one of the really fascinating aspects of this whole field, which also makes it hard but interesting to study, is that these programs, because they come out of unique local contexts, whether at the community level or the state level, they're all designed a little bit differently, and they don't always resemble each other in the details. So you have a very heterogeneous group of programs that you're trying to kind of make sense of together, which is why I spend a lot of time trying to boil down those all the complexities to those three basic decisions. And if you look at the various models that you see out there in the Promise world, there's a lot of variation on all three of those questions.
So let's talk about the money part of it. What is the difference between first dollar and last dollar programs?
Right. So a first dollar program, and this is, you know, scholarship world speak, so you don't need to use it in day-to-day discourse, but that just refers to a scholarship that gets applied to your bill first. So Kalamazoo is a good example. There are very few of these first dollar programs. If you get the Kalamazoo Promise, your tuition at whatever college you get into among these eligible institutions is covered by the Kalamazoo Promise. If you are also eligible for need-based aid from the federal government through Pell Grants, you still get those Pell Grants. You get to add them on top of your tuition scholarship, and of course they help you cover your living expenses and the other expenses involved in going to college. It is an expensive way to structure a scholarship program, and that's why it is almost never done. Most of these scholarship programs are what we call last dollar programs, where your Pell Grants are applied first, and if there is a tuition bill left over, the scholarship program will cover that. Of course, the problem is, for low-income students, they no longer have access to their Pell Grants or to all of their Pell Grants to help with living expenses. So it's not a very equitable structure, but it's a very cost-effective structure, and almost all state and local Promise scholarship programs are structured that way as last-dollar programs. They rely on Pell Grants and often state need-based aid, where states have that, to get them part of the way toward covering the costs.
Pell Grants, we anticipate, will be there, but is this a bit of a house of cards if you build it upon a program that you're not positive will be there?
It can be a house of cards. It's worrisome. Some states have found secure ways to fund these programs, sustainable ways to fund these programs, and Tennessee is an example. They have created a reserve fund out of their lottery proceeds that has plenty of money to cover the Tennessee Promise costs. In other states, and Oregon is an example, the funding for these programs, and Michigan as well, is budget-dependent. And in fact, the rules around the Oregon Promise have changed from year to year based on what is available in the state budget and what the legislature chooses to spend. And that's problematic because it's very hard to issue a very clear message of here are the program rules if they may change next year. So it's important, whatever you're promising, whether you're a community or a state or a college, that you're going to be able to carry through on that commitment. There have been a couple of programs that have had to cut back their benefits, and that's, of course, a very confusing message for students. And students need a very simple message in order to use these programs that are available.
Does this bring us back to what you said at the outset of the book about it is a dangerous time? I mean, are people putting programs out there so fast that they're not putting out programs that can last a while with the same features?
I do think that there is a bit of that going on, particularly among states where funding is insecure. So Michigan created this adult college program called Michigan Reconnect, and they funded it. The uptake has been very, very high. There's tremendous demand for this program. They may have enough money to cover a year of it, but they haven't funded it yet for next year. So that's not great, right? Ideally, you would want multi-year funding, a secure source of sustainable funding, so you can carry through that promise. None of these programs, because they involve going off to college for a year or 2 years or more, they're not super quick silver bullet type programs. They take a while for the effects to unspool.
Stephen Grants Pass dropped off a question by phone. He asks, why don't more private companies invest in scholarship programs, considering they are largely the recipients who benefit from good education, or well-educated workers, we should say?
Yes, that is a great question. And in fact, employers, businesses, used to invest much more in training their workers. And you can look at a range of measures that show that employer-based training has really shrunk. And, of course, one of the reasons is the changes in the workforce that mean people cycle through multiple jobs. So maybe back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, it made sense to invest a lot in training a worker because that worker might stay with you for 20, 30, 40 years, or like my uncles who worked in the aerospace industry, 50 years.
Wow.
That doesn't happen anymore. So some employers do, and obviously apprenticeship programs are an example because they are paid for by employers, are examples. But for the most part, businesses do not take on the responsibility of funding education for their potential workers, which is one reason why they generally like these programs. Now, there's a handful of businesses that have started to add tuition reimbursement programs as a benefit to workers. So UPS does that, Starbucks does that, but that's a little different because not that many workers are really able to take them up on that offer.
It seems like a lot of the agitation for free college, Michelle, comes from outside the academy, and I'm noticing a silence here. I'm not really getting a sense of what the educational institutions themselves are suggesting could be, should be, would be done, things they'd be happy to do to get into this mode.
Yes, I think, they probably would all like to have their funding restored to previously higher levels. And, of course, it depends on what kind of institution you're talking about. When you have a program that will only fund students attending community college, your four-year sectors, your four-year publics are not, you know, they're going to be a little worried because there's a big battle these days going on for enrollment because of the declining pool of the age of students who generally enroll in college. When you have a program that only covers public institutions, the private colleges tend to be unhappy. So, you know, higher ed is very complex. We have these multiple sectors. It looks different from state to state. And these programs are often confine their benefits to one part of the higher ed sector.
With reference to that part of it, though, the community college focus, I mean, here at Southern Oregon University, where I sit, we have a fair number of students that come in from community colleges, and it seems like even if you don't get their money for 4 years, at least you could get them for 2 years, perhaps.
I absolutely agree. I think it's a matter of just for those four-year publics like your own institution and mine, sit tight a couple of years, and you're going to get a bigger flow of students who are transferring from those two-year community college programs. Absolutely right.
So you have some examples side by side. I want to talk about El Dorado Promise and Pittsburgh Promise. Talk about some of the things in which they're similar and different.
Yeah, so actually they, strangely enough, pronounce it El Dorado.
Oh, right.
It's hard to get used to. El Dorado, Arkansas, the program looks very much like the Kalamazoo Promise. It's a very generous program, arguably even more generous because the Kalamazoo Promise only allows you to go to college in the state of Michigan, and El Dorado lets you take your value of your in-state scholarship and go anywhere in the nation. but it's universal. Everyone coming through that school district gets it. The Pittsburgh Promise looks a little bit like the Oregon Promise in that the benefits are restricted, the full benefits of the program are restricted to students graduating with a 2.5 GPA and a 90% attendance rate. There's kind of a, they call it an extension program that allows students a little below that level to get funding to go to the community college and then transfer. And that scholarship program, the largest supporter of that, in both cases actually, the largest supporter of the program is the largest company in the town. In Pittsburgh, it was the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center that put up the initial funding for the program, and then they used that as a match to raise other money. In El Dorado, it was Murphy Oil Corporation, which is the largest, it was the largest employer in town that funded the program. The company has just moved in the past year to Houston and raising a lot of questions about the town's future, although they have promised to continue to fund the El Dorado Promise.
Now, when you talk about equity here, and this goes not just for demographic groups, but also for income groups, first of all, are there some people falling into a donut hole? They make too much to qualify for some of these programs, but not enough for financial aid. And also, is it difficult to target specific racial or demographic groups?
It is very difficult to target. When you have a place-based scholarship that's at the level of a school district or a city or a state or a county, you really can't target it by racial groups. What you can do, and this is what many Promise programs look like, is you can choose a school district as the target of your program that enrolls largely poor students or largely students of color or both. So it's kind of an implicit targeting going on. But one thing about these Promise programs is they very, very rarely have a financial need component. So the donut hole that you describe exists out there in the financial aid landscape. Mm-hmm. If you are just above Pell eligibility level, you're not going to be very well off, but you are not going to have access to federal financial aid, and that is a big donut hole. But the Promise programs don't have that because they are generally needs blind. The key criteria for getting the scholarship is place. Now, Oregon has gone back and forth with having some kind of need ceiling related to the Oregon Promise. But in Tennessee, for example, it doesn't matter what your family earns. You may take advantage of this program.
All right, so we're down to our last minute here, Michelle, and I just want to go away with what your major concern is about moving ahead here, because you do teach political science, so you can see how this would get potentially racked by politics, even if the economics lined up well.
Sure. The president has proposed a national program that would be a shared partnership between the federal government and the states to create a free college program across the nation. Politically, its prospects are iffy, although it is a very popular issue. And then the last thing that I want to mention is that it's not enough just to provide tuition coverage. Students are also going to need support navigating their way to the right post-secondary program and being supported once they're there. So we don't want to neglect that critical element of supporting students who are new to the world of college.
Okay, which as you point out, happened in your family, and so raised your family up for generations. The Path to Free College in Pursuit of Access, Equity, and Prosperity, the latest book from Michelle Miller Adams, professor of political science at Grand Valley State University in Western Michigan and a senior researcher at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you so much, Jeff. I really enjoyed it.
All right, take care.